Welcome to this special episode in celebration of International Open Access Week. My name is Ragna Björk Kristjánsdóttir and I am the library director at Reykjavík University. Every year, the university libraries in Iceland use this opportunity to talk about open access and bring awareness to it. This year's theme is Who Owns Our Knowledge? A question that goes to the heart of how research and ideas are shared globally. Today, we're joined by Jack James, an academic at Reykjavík University who is deeply engaged with the topic of open access. Whether you're a researcher, student, or simply curious about the flow of information in our digital age, this conversation will shed light on the opportunities and challenges of making knowledge truly accessible. So, Jack, can you introduce yourself and maybe tell us a little bit about your view and experience with open access?
Yes, thank you, Ragna. My name is Jack James. I'm Professor of Psychology here at Reykjavík University. Before that, I was Professor and Head of the School of Psychology at the University of Galway in Ireland. And before that, I was Professor and Head of the Department of Behavioural Health Sciences at La Trobe University in Australia. Perhaps we should begin by congratulating the organisers of the International Open Access Week on their choice of theme. They've chosen as their theme the question, who owns our knowledge? On the face of it, the question seems to contain the answer in itself. Who owns our knowledge? Well, if it's our knowledge, we own it. Right? Well, not exactly. Unfortunately, in the world of monetized open access publishing, we don't own our knowledge. Academic publishing is about the dissemination of scholarly and scientific knowledge. And open access can be thought of as being a principle on the one hand and a reality on the other. In principle, open access seeks to provide free and ready access to new scholarly and scientific knowledge to every single individual on the planet. But that's very far from what we have in the reality today. In fact, in talking about open access today, we should probably use the phrase so-called open access in inverted commas. Now, in a lot of discussions about open access, you get the sense that this is a relatively recent idea. Certainly, the term open access is of relative recent origin, having been coined in the early 2000s. However, the idea of open access is a good deal older. Possibly the first explicit statement of open access is to be found in a letter written by the Roman philosopher Seneca the Younger 2,000 years ago. Seneca asserted, all truth is his property. And by all truth, he was referring to knowledge of the shared world. He wasn't talking about private truths like someone's medical history or things of that nature. He went on to argue that the best ideas are common property. In effect, Seneca was asserting access to knowledge as being a common property and as being a basic fundamental human right to which everyone is entitled. Obviously, it was difficult to share information in ancient times. Seneca, for example, wrote his letters on papyrus scrolls, not something that you can readily share with a lot of people. So let's jump forward 1400 years or so to the invention of the printing press by Johannes Gutenberg in 1440. The advent of print was a major step towards the realization of the principle of open access, of providing access to all to scholarly and scientific knowledge. And it's also served as a major catalyst, that is, print served as a major catalyst for the advent of scientific journals pretty much as we know them today. With the advent, most of the, or more or less for the past, for the next 300 years or so, when the first journals came into being in the mid 17th century in France and Britain, for more or less the next 300 years, most scientific and academic journals were owned by professional associations, not-for-profit professional societies. And it's evident from their practices that they very much were seeking to provide as much open access as possible. First of all, the authors, by tradition, offer their work without payment. The work is reviewed by scholarly peers, and final editorial decisions are made by senior scholar editors, also generally without pay. So all of this free labour is clear evidence that there was a strong commitment to achieving maximum open access as possible. Now, of course, print is not without its costs. You have the paper, you have the machinery, you have the typesetting, you have the distribution of the physical product, all of which entails costs. So the non-for-profit associations needed to recoup those costs, and they did that primarily by way of subscription. And subscription were mostly undertaken by institutional libraries, primarily university libraries. So people belonging to such an institution had ready and open access to a vast array of scholarly and scientific knowledge. Now, while this was a major step in the direction of open access, it fell short of being universal open access because of all those people not belonging to such an institution and not having the same ready access to this new knowledge. But then in the late 20th century, we have the advent of digital processing and the internet. Finally, at last, it looked like it might be possible to achieve something approximating universal open access. Because print costs were removed and all of the free labour was continuing, you just had the minimal costs of uploading material to the internet. So what happened then? Well, what happened was that rather than there being a reduction in costs of accessing scholarly and scientific knowledge, there was a massive escalation in the cost of access.
So what is the reality of open access publishing as we know it today?
Well, the reality is that we have a monetized system of open access publishing. It's evident that the major commercial publishers of the day saw that there was this invaluable commodity that was being produced for virtually no cost whatsoever. There's this global consumer base and all of this free labour contributing to producing this material, this commodity, and print, which was the major cost previously, had now been eliminated. So they evidently saw that there was an opportunity for making profit out of this commodity. So beginning in the early 1990s, we had the corporatization of academic publishing. The major publishers began buying up the rights to publish from the professional associations. And this happened relatively quickly. Within a relatively short period of time, the top five publishers came to own more than 50% of all of the academic journals. And even then, the distribution is not even because they focus their attention on the better established and more reputable journals of the day. So, what then happened? All right, so you have now the transfer of the ownership of the journals from professional associations to commercial companies. What happened in terms of the costs? Well, did they reduce the subscription costs? Because basically all of the costs had been removed, they'd still make a handsome profit. Or did they even leave the costs where they were, the subscription costs where they were, and make an enormous profit because the costs had been more or less eliminated? No, they didn't do either of those things. There was a sudden huge increase in the cost of subscriptions, leading to what came to be known as the serials crisis. The serials crisis was such that even the best provisioned and most prestigious universities in the world could no longer afford the totality of the subscriptions to which they were accustomed to prior to that. Even the richest universities had to start cutting back their subscriptions because they couldn't afford the sudden massive increases in costs. So it's important to recognize at this point that we're talking about a commodity, new knowledge, which is mostly taxpayer funded and therefore rightfully belongs to the taxpayer. So what did the various authorities do? The governments, the funding agencies, the institutional librarians, and indeed the scholarly community as a whole, what did they do when this product belonging to the public was now being monetized to an absurd degree? Well, they complained a lot, but they capitulated. Instead of refusing, they capitulated. They tried to negotiate package deals and such like, but in the end, they more or less caved in and played ball with the commercial publishers. So, bad as that might seem, is that where it stopped? No, it even gets worse. It wasn't long before the commercial publishers began to adopt the mantra of open access. Basically, what they did is they took the concept of open access, turned it on its head, and drained it of all its original meaning. And this is exemplified by so-called gold open access. Interesting term, really, because it's hard to know why it's referred to as gold open access. Maybe it's a marketing ploy to try to give the practice a kind of golden sheen. But in reality, it's better considered to be a perverse joke, where the only sense in which gold open access is gold is that it represents a bottomless pot of gold for the commercial publishers. So what is gold open access? Well, gold open access is where the author, after all their hard work, brings their article to the publisher to be published and distributed to the world at large. And at that point, the publisher says, no, we're not going to accept this free gift. You have to pay us to accept this gift, and then we'll publish it. That payment is referred to as an article processing charge. It's so bizarre, it's a kind of rough analogy would be someone going into a supermarket, taking a loaf of bread off the shelf, going to the checkout counter, and demanding that they, the consumer, be paid $5 by the supermarket for the bread that they have in their shopping basket. The checkout person would not only call the police, they'd call the psychiatric services because the person in question would have to be mad. Mad as they may be, that's more or less what we have with gold open access. Now, the extent of the profitability when you combine the hike in the subscription charges and the introduction of previously totally unheard of and completely unimaginable processing charges, article processing charges, the extent of the profitability in this scam operation can be seen. It's estimated that something like $20 billion is spent in sales of scholarly journals and articles. That's $20 billion of wasted taxpayer money, money that could otherwise be used to support further research or other public good. And the extent of the scam can be seen in the profit margins, the size of the profit margins. Elsevier, the biggest academic publisher, has a profit margin estimated to be in the region of 40%. And this is more or less unparalleled in the commercial world. Even the biggest and most profitable companies like Microsoft, Google, and Apple don't have profit margins of that extent. Now, it's been estimated that the real cost of publishing a single article in a scholarly journal is about $10, maybe less, but let's say $10. I did a survey of the top biomedical journals and examined their, of the top 100 biomedical journals and examined their article processing charges. And the charges range from a low, I emphasize a low, of $100, which is 10 times the real cost, all the way up to more than $12,000 for a single article, which is what the journal Nature charges. So Nature is charging more than 1,000 times what the real cost is. It's totally absurd, obviously absurd. Another question you can ask about this is, all of these journals are more or less doing the same thing. They're receiving articles for free from authors. The articles are being reviewed for free, and editorial decisions are being mostly made for free. They're all doing the same thing. How come the charge, even the lowest charge, is excessive, but how come the range of charges can be a range of more than 100-fold when they're all more or less doing the same thing? Well, the answer to that is they charge whatever they can get away with. And their experience has been that they can get away with a lot. We, the academic community, and all of the authorities involved are allowing them to get away with highway robbery.
So what do you think are the benefits and harms of monetized academic publishing?
Yeah, that's a good question. What are the benefits and harms? Well, so far as benefits are concerned, that's easy to answer. Basically, there are none. There is no scholarly analysis that has demonstrated a benefit from monetized academic publishing that can't otherwise be achieved through not-for-profit collectives and communities and professional associations. With regard to harms, there are many, and many serious harms. Let's begin. Typical of the marketplace, if there's easy money to be made, you tend to have more players. And that's exactly what's happened in the area of monetized academic publishing. There's been an enormous proliferation of new journals and articles being published. It's estimated that there is something like 50,000 journals at the present time publishing more than 5 million articles a year. Now, you might say, okay, more articles, that means more knowledge, right? No, not exactly. Again, no serious scholarly analysis supports that. Quite the opposite. With the increased proliferation of scholarly and scientific articles being published, we've seen a decline in editorial standards. And that decline is entirely understandable if you examine the incentives involved. On the one hand, you have the incentives for profit, the profit incentive for the publisher to publish as many articles that for which they receive processing charges as they can. And on the other hand, you have the academics themselves who are all too happy to publish as many articles as they can in order to boost their reputation and their CVs. So these combined incentives provide a important or massive or strong dual disincentive to maintain editorial standards. And all of the evidence suggests that standards have been declining. This is evidenced by, for example, the advent of predatory journals. Now, in one sense, you could regard all monetized academic journals as being predatory. However, the term predatory is generally reserved for those journals which actively solicit gold open access articles, that is, articles for which they receive article processing charges, and apply little, if any, editorial scrutiny. So long as they're getting paid, they're happy to publish whatever they can get. And associated with that, we then have the rise of what is referred to as paper mills. This is effectively organized crime, where an individual or a group of individuals writes articles, offers them for sale for eager academics to submit to see if they can have them published. So basically, the paper mills are the drug dealers, and the academics in this instance are the addicts seeking more and more articles. All of this all of these anomalies, all of these harms, all of these scams have been associated with a massive increase in forced article retractions. That is, an article is published only to find that it must be retracted at a later stage. One study estimated that there were more than 10,000 retractions in 2023 alone, and the authors described that number as just the tip of the iceberg. It's a global phenomenon. It's happening everywhere, although some countries are overrepresented. Countries such as China, Russia, and India account for more, a disproportionate number of article retractions. But as I say, it is a global phenomenon. Even the most prestigious universities like Harvard and Stanford have seen an increase in article retractions, forced article retractions. Of course, there can be legitimate reasons for retracting an article. Someone earnestly publishes a paper and then subsequently discovers that an error was made, for example, in the analysis. They contact the editors and ask the paper be withdrawn because they can't stand over the conclusions any longer. But those legitimate retractions account for just a tiny minority of the total. Most retractions are because the articles have been faked or scammed or involved fraudulent data. Not surprising, then, that we see a rise now in what has come to be called the reproducibility crisis. This is where researchers are increasingly reporting that they're not able to reproduce the findings that they're reading about reported in the journals. This is on the increase. And not surprising when you consider the decline in editorial standards and the eagerness with which people are ready to publish whatever they can get away with. But it has a very unfortunate effect in creating mistrust amongst scientists themselves and certainly also amongst the general public, a mistrust of science in general, which is extremely harmful. Also, not surprising, with the proliferation of journals and articles being published, you have an increase in the workload of peer reviewers. Peer reviewers who are offering their labour for free are now being inundated by mountains of requests to review articles. And this is leading to burnout and what is being referred to as the peer review crisis. Perhaps in this context, I could refer to my own experience. In the past, I never declined an invitation to review an article for which I had relevant expertise. Didn't matter how busy I was, I always found time to do it because I considered it to be a fundamental professional responsibility which I wasn't, under any circumstances, prepared to shirk. For a long time now, I have been declining invitations to serve as a reviewer. On one hand, I would guess that the average person in the street would think this was perfectly reasonable. Why should I offer my hard-won expertise for free to someone who's going to make a handsome profit simply by uploading the finished product to the internet? Most people would think that that's perfectly reasonable. Why should I participate with that? But that's not the reason I decline. The reason I decline is out of principle. Even if they offered to pay me, I would still decline. It's not the payment that is key here. It's the principle. The fact is that monetized academic publishing is bad for science, and I refuse to participate in that process. The extent of the corruption that is currently going on within monetized academic publishing, open access publishing, so-called, is indicated by the occasional scam article that is written by a scientist or by a journalist, seeing what they can get away with. So they write an article, a nonsensical article, by non-existent authors or fictional authors, even at fictional institutions, submit the article to various journals and see if they can have it published. And the astonishing thing is the success rate of such submissions. Now, we wouldn't, on one hand, we might not be too surprised if the predatory journals, the recognized predatory journals, would be prepared to publish anything because they're getting paid for it. But the reality is that time and again it's been found that even the most best known of the big academic publishers, the big monetized academic publishers, also have been found to fall victim to such scams, despite the fact that they're constantly reminding us of what high standards they have. So they too are part of the sting. They fall victim to the sting operation, the sting operations that have been conducted in this regard. Finally, I guess amongst harms, I think it's important to mention there's the harm of complicity. The fact that all of the authorities and the entire academic community, or virtually the entire academic community, is participating in this process. And I think this participation reveals an extreme failure to adhere to ethical principle and moral obligation. Participation in monetized open access publishing is demonstrably and has been clearly demonstrated to be harmful to science and scholarly activity, and therefore we should not be complicit in that process.
So what to do?
That's a good question. And there are quite a number of fair-minded and earnest people volunteering their time, pursuing a range of options to try to circumvent and undermine monetized open access publishing. Probably the most widespread would be various archiving options where an individual scientist might archive their work and have it freely accessible, or an institution might archive the work of their researchers within the institution as a group and have that readily accessible to anybody who's interested. And also networks of scholars. You see this particularly, I think, in maths and physics. They've had reasonable success here. Networks of scholars working within disciplines, sharing their work between themselves, reviewing it between themselves, and making it accessible to whoever may wish to access it. Also, we have pirate open access, which is where an individual or a group accesses the archives of the commercial publishers and accesses a body of literature and basically steals it and uploads it to the internet, making it freely available to anyone who's interested without payment to the pirate operators. Now, this is widely regarded as being illegal for obvious reasons, I guess, but I would argue, and I have argued in my published work, that this should be regarded as legitimate civil disobedience in the time-honoured tradition of refusing to obey unreasonable rules and regulations which are clearly unfair and exploitative. Then most people in most places regard that as a legitimate and not illegal thing to do. And that's how we should regard use of pirate open access. Now, all of these activities are useful and they're doing good. But unfortunately, to date at least, they've been operating more or less at local levels and at the periphery, at the margins of the mainstream of academic publishing. So to date, we've not yet seen any major disruptive effect on the operations of the commercial publishers. And that's what we need to see. So whilst it's good that this is happening, the impact has been limited to date, and there's no real indication that this is going to change anytime soon if the same practices are repeated. But on the other hand, we have an overwhelming moral obligation to stop this, monetization of knowledge which belongs to the public, is mostly paid for by the public, belongs to the public, and yet the public is being denied access unless they pay additional funds to access it. We have to find ways to stop this practice. It's an unacceptable misappropriation of taxpayer property and money. So ways must be found to divest corporations of their assets, their journal assets. Ways must be found of journals being reclaimed by not-for-profit, by non-profit professional associations and communities. We simply must do that. And I think the experience to date indicates that the operating at the margins, the localized activity and so on, important and useful as it may be, isn't going to have the disruptive effect that it needs to have. So that what really is required is coordinated national and international action to reclaim ownership of the what is basically public knowledge. And I suspect that if this were to be done, I don't see any clear signals of it being done yet or movements in that direction, but it really is required. It requires national and international coordination. Any such action, I believe, would necessarily be disruptive to the flow and the creation of new knowledge, but that disruption could, if the right actions are taken, be short-term and would be, I believe, a necessary an appropriate price to pay to reclaim ownership of what is public knowledge. So I guess to end on the note, on a note in keeping with the theme of this event, what must be done is us, for all of us, to reclaim ownership of our knowledge. And hopefully that can be done.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Jack, for this very insightful conversation about open access and the ownership of knowledge. If you found this episode thought-provoking, consider sharing it with your colleagues or students during Open Access Week. Let's keep the dialogue going, because knowledge should be a public good, not a privilege. So take care and stay curious.